I'm Zank. We're here with Mike Newton. His website is called hackingphotography.com. Mike's going to talk to our San Diego startup group about all sorts of things from apps to ebooks and everything he's been doing basically since 2011. And just so I can share with everyone a personal story, Mike Newton wrote for me a very specific email that I sent out to roughly 1,500 bands that were going to be at South by Southwest this year, this past year in 2013, achieving a click-through rate of greater than 13%, an open rate of over 60%, numbers that are just insane, like nothing I'd ever seen before or even heard of. And no one I know has ever heard of those types of rates. So Mike has been coming to our startup groups every week and a huge contributor, and we just want to get some insight about what he's, you know, what gets into his head that allows him to write such an email, and where did it all start, and what's he been working on, because it's all very interesting stuff. Very talented kid. We're all kids, right? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's cool. Fine.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike.
Got it. Thanks for the intro. Yeah, I was happy to help Zank and Michelle in that email. My background here is that I've been working with different tech companies, mostly in a sales capacity. Sold knives in college, which is always funny to think back and look back on. But that kind of paved the way for my sales career. It's funny, you take something like selling knives and it's all funny and people laugh at you until you tell them you sold 200 grand yourself, which is great. Anyway, that really paved the way. And as soon as I was done with college, I went into sales capacities, different companies, and I've been with a startup company in San Diego now for about 5 years, and a lot of the email things that I put together come from my role is essentially business development. So I get our product into the hand of media groups. So that capacity really requires me calling and pitching media companies all day by phone, email, LinkedIn, Facebook, really anything you could possibly imagine. Side note, make sure I have a reminder at some point in the future, Zank, to give everybody a strategy on how to go about gaming LinkedIn and getting through to anyone you ever wanted to automatically without doing any of the work.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about this last time we met, but you've got some more strategy for that now.
Right.
Very cool.
So I'll go back. Maybe that's a topic for a whole future meeting, because I was able to, without doing any of the work myself through outsourcing and through really creating a whole path, get through to the top of like Warner Brother Records and Hearst Media and groups like that, straight to basically the presidents, you know, the seven-figure people that I was amazed that I could reach that quickly and that easily.
Maybe that's a guest blog, you know, if you want to do in the future and put up on the site.
Yeah. So back to the email, it certainly helped. I didn't have to craft it from scratch. So Zank already had supplied me with kind of what he had ready to go and said, can you look this over? And it had a really good flow to it. It just was still really product focused. And I've learned in pitching all these media companies that these guys get hit over the head every day from 1,000 people just like me. And everybody's more than likely doing what they think that person cares about, which is product features and how this is going to make your life easier. And they write this super long, detailed email, when in reality, as you guys all know, if we get an email from someone we don't know, we look at the name first. I don't know this person. We might graze the subject line, which has to be compelling. And then if we're lucky enough to make it through the first sentence and we're not instantly hooked, we just start kind of randomly scanning the email for, who knows, keywords. And if we don't see something interesting, we just delete it. So I've learned that the long emails I've put together in the past were basically just shit. So I've kind of had to really just cut it back and go, okay, one, they're not going to know me, so can I make a really simple but compelling subject line so they don't immediately delete it? So I can't remember what the subject line was for yours, but maybe we can just send that out to everyone afterwards.
Yeah, I'll post the whole thing.
So the whole point is, can we get them through the subject line to open the email? And number one, we got them through there. The second part was to have a really friendly and personal introduction. So this was a list that we'd never talked to. You know, we never had any interaction. They didn't know who we were. So I had to kind of humanize the whole thing. And that was really step one, is in the first sentence was to introduce us in such a way that we're just your friend. We're not a company. You know, we're a fellow musician. We're going to South by Southwest, which was the topic of the email. And it was very human. So suddenly, okay, in the first sentence we've established, I'm a real person. I'm not someone here to pitch a product or whatever the case may be. I'm a real person. So that helped out. And then really progressively throughout the email, it was, can I get them through this next sentence? And it's literally, you have to look at the structure of an email that way, is, okay, I know who this person is, now what? And then can you get them through the next sentence? Is that warm enough and personal enough without being pitchy that, you know, that they'll want to keep reading? And it's as well to keep it really short. The whole point of an email is just to create an introduction, and then you can go into more detail after that. You should never make the email super long and try to include everything you possibly can in an email. So the purpose of that email was to, you know, get the next step. I think you were going
to
say something.
You know, Mike, to be fair to myself, I really did a lot of diligence, you know, before I wrote that email. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was 95% there. I wrote it like a press release, which mm-hmm. is, I guess, what you'd probably think I would do, right? I read, you know, I know sort of how to write copy on a website. Mm-hmm. But an email is not a website. And I think that's where I got confused, because I had great sort of benefits over features type mm-hmm. copy. I understood that. And then I put bullet points because I know people don't read. They sort of muddle through.
Right.
And then, you know, I gave it a very sort of personal ending and said, you know, goodbye. And what you did was you built so much on that. You made it so personal. And that was, I think, the biggest missing link for me mm-hmm. was that an email can, and from what I'm gaining, should be so personal. And that's really what I took from. Mm-hmm. So everything I do now, when it's sort of email one-on-one related, I try to make it much more personal and try to include fewer benefits.
Right.
Is that sort of...
Entirely. And I should probably back up. I was more referring to my initial emails when I started in sales than what you gave me. I wrote, like, you know, page-long emails with all this way too many features, and just assumed, oh, well, here's my entire product scope, and if they read this, they'll get it. But no, Zanky, you already had a really good outline, and really it just took a little bit of polishing just on... It's okay to be a person, and it's okay to talk casually. I think a lot of people think they might need to be a little bit more polished and professional, but I talk in my emails just like I talk right now, you know, to everyone else, and that goes a long way.
Cool. Yeah, definitely wouldn't have gotten there, so thanks.
For sure. So I kind of want to start this off, and, you know, you kind of know up to this point my history. I've been in a sales capacity with a startup for a long time, and, you know, ultimately... Like many of you guys on the call listening to this, Tim Ferriss ruined my life in a positive way. I read the 4-Hour Workweek, and it really was a giant paradigm shift, completely and totally, unlike anything I'd ever read. And you know, I do credit Tim Ferriss for a lot of the ways that I think that I think and a lot of us think. And you know, after reading that book in 2007, I'd had a million ideas, and I'd always thought about things and planned things out and made checklists, and just I never actually took the action. I think I personally fall into, you know, overanalyzing everything and never really just taking the leap, if you will. So that all kind of came to a head, and it was January 1st, 2012. And I just kind of, for whatever reason, you know, New Year's and you're thinking about things that, you know, you should be thinking about every day, but we save till the first day of the year, like it matters. And I just decided, okay, that's it. This is going to be the year where I make shit happen. And I had a very specific goal in mind. And the goal is maybe contrary to what most people might think of. And my goal that I had written down for 2012 was I wanted to make more mistakes than I ever had in my entire life in 2012. And that was a big deal. It was a big paradigm shift, because my overanalyzing always came from, what if I screw up? Or I don't know what I'm doing, and what if I do this wrong? And that kind of paralysis from analysis always kept me from taking action. So I kind of gave myself permission to screw up as much as I humanly could and really just fail, you know, as many times as I could in 2012. And if I failed more than I ever did, then I would hit my goal. So it's kind of a reverse goal. But it worked really well, because now I wasn't afraid of failing when that was the entire purpose. So how many times can I screw up? So ultimately, if I do that, it means I'm actually taking action and I'm starting to try to make things happen. So I'd always wanted to get into the iPhone app space. I had zero knowledge of this. I bought a couple books online, most of which were not good. One of which, called App Empire, was fantastic. I recommend everybody read that if you want to get into the iPhone app space. So I started taking action. I had always really enjoyed photography. I'm a photographer. That's my entire purpose of what I want to do with my life, not necessarily as a profession, but just as a passion. So I always enjoyed making collages through, and I'm going to kind of open the kimono here and kind of tell you guys where the product came from, what my sales numbers are, profitability, everything. So the thought was, my wife and I had made these really big photo collages at our wedding a couple of years back. And it was a pretty slick product. It was actually through the Costco Photo Center. They had this thing where you could just upload all your photos. You click a single button and it would arrange them all automatically into this really cool kind of collage. And if you didn't like the way the images were arranged, you could just click a single button and it would shuffle them all around. It would create an entire new arrangement. So you could literally just keep shuffling this arrangement of images until the layout showed up the way that you wanted it. And that always kind of stuck with me, how slick that product was. And I couldn't find anything like that on iPhone or Android. And there was plenty of other kind of collage type of apps or frame apps where they would give you pre-laid out, you know, wireframes that you could upload photos to, but nothing quite like that. So that was really the idea. I was just going to basically steal Costco's idea of what they already had in their photo center and put it on iPhone. It was nothing revolutionary. It was just, I would use this. I know a lot of other photographers who use these collage programs, and it was something that was already proven. There was a lot of apps already out there like that. That's a big misconception I think a lot of people have, is they have to be the first. If you're the first to do an app, run the other direction, because it means it's unproven, and likely it should have been monetized by now. So I just took something that was already out there that people were already buying in droves, and I wanted to just change it up enough that it was, you know, a new twist, if you will, a new concept. So January 1st, we had the idea. We decided to map it all out. So what I mean by that is we took 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper and drew it out with a Sharpie marker. Here's kind of what we think. You know, I've never designed products before. I've never been a software developer. I'm not a graphic designer. I have no clue what I'm doing at this point. So again, making mistakes is good. So I laid out what I thought we would want, and then we just got onto Elance.com because I read about it on 4-Hour Workweek. And we put up an ad with basically a product scope that we wrote out. Again, we didn't know what we were doing. We just thought, here's kind of what we think we need. Here is, you know, the general gist of it. And I did that on January 2nd. January 3rd, we already had 25 different proposals for this app. Within, I believe, the first 8 hours. It was astounding to me. And this happened at like midnight. It was midnight Central Time in St. Louis, Missouri. We're hanging out with family. And the next morning, I had all these proposals. I'm like, holy shit, this really works, you know? All right, outsourcing. This is great. So we went through the process. We vetted vendors. And by that, I mean we kind of took a random guess. Again, I'm not a developer. Just by looking at their feedback on Elance, what the prices were. And we ended up choosing a company that had done some pretty big name apps, you know, that we knew, we used, we trusted. Their feedback was fantastic. They'd done a lot of jobs on Elance. So we hired them, I think it was January 5th. So it moved pretty quickly. So the quote on what they gave me was that the app was going to be done according to our product specifications. They were going to do graphic design, and it was going to be done March 23rd. So what ended up happening was the design aspect really was lacking. The company, you'll find a lot of times that developers are not good designers. I thought they had both people on staff, mistakenly, which they didn't. So I ended up spending $575 to have 99designs.com do that, which is basically kind of a crowdsourced contest where people can create all these wireframes. So 99designs did all of the graphic design. So the initial budget for the app that I was given, we chose between two companies. One was $3,000 and one was $4,000. Having never been in this, I thought, yeah, that's fair. I don't know what I'm doing. So we had quotes ranging from $600 all the way up to $15,000. The $15,000 actually came from a local U.S. company, not surprisingly, which was, needless to say, out of my budget. So we chose between the first and second company. The first one was $3,000, second one was $4,000. We chose the higher end because their app portfolio they showed on Elance had a lot of apps that we knew, we trusted, we had used.
So Mike, is that one of the big determinants? I know this is something that all of us face. You know, mm-hmm. I hired yesterday. What did I do to hire? And so will you tell me what the main things were? So you said their portfolio was good. Did you look at other reviews or how long, how many hours they'd worked?
So what I looked at, the kind of performance indicators through Elance, I wanted, there were a lot of cheap providers that had very little experience, at least as rated through Elance. So Elance is a marketplace where you can see every job that's been done through Elance, how they've been rated by previous customers. You can look at samples of their work. They can upload their portfolio of what they've done. So I really wanted someone who was kind of a player here, and I was willing to pay more for it. So I wanted someone who had done a lot of apps. They had about 200 apps in their portfolio in Elance. I was able to download those apps from the App Store, play with them, see what the reviews were like. Not necessarily how good the quality of the app was, but really to make sure there were no bugs, it wasn't crashing, because you know, they just code it. They're not responsible for the concept, or half the time, not even the graphic design behind the app. So I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't buggy or broken. So we chose the company that was on the higher end. They were $4,000. And then after a while, we realized that they didn't quite get the design angle we wanted. So I had to pay out of pocket again to go and have it done through 99 Designs, which added 500 and something bucks on it. So now my budget's just gone up. I was supposed to be done with the app on March 23rd. So about a 2-month timeline. Unfortunately, what happened is it kept dragging out. The company, I realized very quickly, my fault completely for not checking this, is their English skills were abhorrent. Very, very bad. Completely my fault for not checking. It was an odd thing to me, so I'm gonna give you guys all of the fun things that happened that were terrible, because we can laugh about them now in retrospect. About a month and a half in, this company got kicked off of Elance for violating terms. So when I asked what it was, they were being kind of dodgy about it. And about a month afterwards, things had slowed down. I come to find out that they were including apps in their portfolio that they did not actually develop. So suddenly apps like Jet Setter and Radio Shack and Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, which is actually one of my clients at my other company, my fault again for not calling them to verify a reference. I didn't check any references, which is, in retrospect, really dumb of me. I found out that the only way they were to get their profile re-enlisted was to update their portfolio with apps they had actually done, which now suddenly was about 10. Those apps that they could show were all horrible. We were so far down the development path that I was too scared to kind of quit that job, pull the code over, and have someone else start over again, because I just didn't know any better. So I decided to stick it out with them. We get into April, we get into May, we get into June, we get into July, we get into August. It keeps going. Installers keep going. Every installer seems like we fix one thing, but then there's two more bugs. We're dealing with this. They can't get this right. So after a while, we ended up having to fire that company and go back to the drawing board for a week or two to find another company to take over to fix it, because it got so bad.
So Mike, what's your advice to companies that are getting into building an app? And I know you're going to talk a little bit more later about a quote smarter way to build an app.
Right.
But if you had to go back, you know, with the, you know, what do they say? Hire slowly, fire up very quickly. You know, and I know you started to throw good money after bad at a certain point.
Right.
You know, what's your advice if you're building an app and you start to see a trend like this? You know, it's very hard to pull the plug, but, you know, what do you think you would do again?
So what I would do again is, and Zenk nailed it, and I was going to cover that, is that exact terminology. It's be slow to hire and quick to fire. I'd read that. I was just too scared because I'm not a developer. And I just thought that, you know, okay, well, how long is it going to take for someone else to pick up where they left off? You know, is a scary thing as a first-time person going through this process. What if someone doesn't quite get it and the first company has this kind of false power over you? And that was just, you know, my mistake to not know that that's the right thing to do. So anyway, now what we look for when we work with people is to give them, you know, kind of a trial. And be very clear and direct. The first time a mistake is made, let it be very clearly known how this affects it and that it needs to be corrected, or you can find someone else. And if it does happen again, find someone else. Don't make the mistake that I did and stick with a sinking ship, which will slow your development time from what was supposed to be March 23rd, ended up being September 25th. So I ended up 6 months behind schedule. And due to one variable or another, I ended up at about $6,000, which is what the cost went up to from the initial $4,000 that I was expecting.
So an extra 50% on top of what you had expected.
Yeah, that's basically, we went from $4,000 to $6,000 in development costs. So anyway, so to kind of fast forward, we're now in September. We're ready to get the app pushed out. We're finally done. We're with our second development company. Up to this point, the second development company has been fantastic. Their work has been quick. They've been easy to communicate with. All the mistakes we made from the first one were kind of corrected. So at this point, we submitted the app to Apple, which is a whole submitted process. They have to go through and review it, make sure there's no big mistakes that you didn't catch. And really, at this point, you didn't really have control over it. You submit it to Apple, and you kind of wait until they give you the green light to go live. So it took them 3 weeks from when we submitted it to when it goes live. I was told typically between a week or two. So unfortunately, by the time it went live, My wife Dominique and I were in Milan, Italy. We had just gone on our first trip internationally. I'd never been overseas. I'm excited. I've got my camera. I'm like ready to just take the best photos of my life because that's what I'm about. And 2 days into our trip in Milan, we get the notice that the app just went live. It's like, well, this is great because now I'm here for 12 more days and I can't really do a lot to promote it. I can't, you know, whatever. So I thought, well, we'll just let it kind of sit and then we'll really deal with it when we get back. So we updated Facebook remotely from the apartment on Airbnb where you're staying at. We updated Facebook twice with the app and just kind of left it alone. And so I have a report here in front of me. I'll pass this around from, you know, all this work, all this effort, you know, all these things. And we're on vacation when this thing goes live. So day one, let me look this up. So the big fear, right, is when an app goes live is no one's ever going to see this thing. I don't have time to promote it. And it's just going to go fall by the wayside.
You had a bit of the opposite problem, though.
So it was kind of an interesting thing, right? So day one, zero promotion on day one because we didn't know about it till day two. 565 downloads. So my app at this point, it's called Collage Frames Shuffle. Again, check the name before you actually code the app. Because we had Collage Frames, which some jerk took somehow without us knowing. And so at the last second, we had to add a third word since our word was already taken and we'd already done design and everything else. So what should have been Collage Frames and all the, you know, Twitter icons and everything else were taken became Collage Frames Shuffle, which is a little bit more difficult. So anyway, app went live, 565 downloads day one, zero promotion. The app was free with basic features and then a $1 optional upgrade. So it was a freemium model. We had 30 people upgrade and pay a buck day one. Day two was just shy of 2,000 downloads and 57 upgrades. Day three was 1,172 downloads, 40 upgrades. Day four was 900 downloads. So this thing very quickly started getting between 1,000 and 2,000 downloads a day, of which anywhere from 130 people a day were upgrading. Wow. So suddenly my whole life had been working, trading my time for a check. And it was exciting, to say the least, to be in Italy and to pop into a, you know, random coffee shop in Florence and suddenly see that we had made $500 that day.
So how
without
often,
interacting.
How often were you checking into those coffee shops after that?
right. I was trying not to. So it was exciting, right? So the app explodes. I have no idea how this happened. We built in a couple things to help people share it, but honestly, I think it was just a product that kind of hit home with the right audience, because I am that audience. So everything is exciting. Life is exciting. We're traveling. We're making money. We're getting paid. It just keeps increasing. You know, we're getting 100, 200 downloads or rather paid upgrades a day. Life is good, and I see the light. Right now, it's like everything you've read about, you know, in the 4-hour work week. Holy hell, for the first time in my life, I'm making money and I'm not actually touching it. I'm not trading my time for that. And it's the most exciting thing, I think, that, you know, ever in my business career. Even though it's maybe $100, you know, in a day, that's something that I wasn't responsible for touching. It was just happening. I didn't have to do anything. So I see the light. I'm having fun. I'm taking photos. We're having a blast in Italy. Life is good. And then about 3 days into it, the negative feedback starts happening on iTunes. So here's where the story takes a very tragic twist as the plotline evolves. Unbeknownst to me, what had happened is the developers who developed the app somehow incorrectly coded the in-app purchase and Apple didn't catch it. So what worked fine in testing before we went live, suddenly people were accepting and paying the 99 cents for the upgrade to the app. And the app would say, great, we've charged you, and then nothing would happen. We weren't delivering the upgrade. So the next time someone would try to use one of the premium features, it would say, oh, great, do you want to upgrade for 99 cents when they just paid for it? You can imagine how that goes over after the two or three prompts, which are automatically coded into the app to bug people throughout the experience. Do you want to upgrade or not when they've already done it?
I'll try to find your email to me about that exact topic that you sent me from Italy when I asked you how things are going.
So suddenly I find out that I'm now an international thief and that I am stealing people's money while on vacation, which now I'm a little concerned. So just as fast as the app took off like a rocket, a bomb went off and it starts falling to earth because the new users don't know this yet, but now people are getting upset and starting to leave, you know, one-star reviews when all their other ones were five-star. So after a while, those one-star reviews start outweighing the five stars, which starts killing my ranking and starts dropping my downloads. So I'll pass this around again. I have a screenshot of my app rankings for the first 7 days versus the first 30 days. And you'll kind of see what happens there. So we caught it on about the second day, maybe third day. And of course, I proceeded to have a fun conversation with our developers on why this happened and why we didn't catch this. So they fixed the problem. It took them about 5 days to fix this coding problem. We then submitted the upgrade to Apple, which then took 2 weeks to approve it and send it live through the store. So I now have 3 weeks worth of negative reviews and quite expected, and you know, they probably should have been pretty upset. I think I would be pretty upset as well. So by the time we fixed it, by the time we got that update pushed live, the app had petered off quite a bit. So at that point, we're now down to maybe a couple hundred downloads a day and maybe, you know, $40-$50 a day in sales. And it really just never came back after that. So that was a very detrimental process in that by the time we fixed it, excitement had worn off, our visibility had worn off in the iTunes store, and the app really just kind of fell back to the earth. So pros and cons of that. Cons, obviously, is it sucked. And what could have been a very promising app didn't turn out that way, I feel, not because of us, but because of our developers. And honestly, I don't know if there's anything I could have done differently, because we tested it and it worked perfectly before we launched it. So the pro of what I learned in this is, like, it gave me just enough of a glimmer of what's possible. So it's melancholy but exciting to think about what would have happened had that in-app purchase worked properly. You know, it was taken off like a rocket, and what would have happened had that not been a detriment to the product? So we've been kind of working on it since then. We've sent, you know, updates to fix that problem, and never really quite returned to where it was, regardless of marketing. So nowadays, so I'll go get into the numbers. So overall, we spent $6,000 on the app. Overall, total, since we've launched it, I believe we've had around 2,200 upgrades to the app. So I'm still in the red. I believe
$100.
So 2,200 upgrades at a buck, Apple takes 30%. So I get 70% of that. So we're still in the red by probably, you know, $4,000, maybe $4,500. So we just spent a little bit more to upgrade the app. And one mistake I made as well is I never included the ability to make push notifications, because that required creating a database, which I didn't know I needed to do. Again, complete uneducation here, and I should have asked people who've done it before. Thus why I recommend reading App Empire, because had I read that book in advance, none of this would have been a problem. That was massive. So since then, we're probably doing around $150 to $200 in net profit per month now. It's really not much. It'll take me years to recoup that, but it's still exciting as an investment that it's completely passive. I do, much to my own detriment, absolutely nothing to promote this anymore. Yeah. I don't Facebook post, I don't tweet about it, I don't really do much of anything, but it's still generating, you know, a little bit of money a month. So what I've learned. So let's kind of peel back the onion on what I've learned through that whole process. We decided we're going to make another app about halfway through the summer. This one relating to tintype photography, which is an old method in the 1800s of making these real cool old style, you know, photographs.
Mike, before you switch gears, sure. I'm real excited to hear about this part of it. I'd love for you to talk about two different things. What made the rocket take off in the very beginning? Because you said you compared it to a rocket, and it really was. And then you told me about this, but I'd love for the group to know. What was the good that came from all the negative reviews? Mm-hmm. And you talked about how you reversed some of that. It's something that everyone's got to deal with. I had an awful call. Was it this morning or was it yesterday? Yeah, it was yesterday. And I know what I did, but you're very good in this sector. Mm-hmm. What did you do? So if you can talk about, you know, how your app, or why you think your app really took off in the beginning, and sort of put a hat on that, and then and talk about, you know, how you dealt with the negativity and how you turned it around a little bit.
Good point. So I'll start off with how we promoted the app, which was much to my detriment. You read this all the time about apps, is that everybody gets caught up in the features and the product, and they focus zero on marketing. I fell into that camp. So I really didn't do much to market this. What I did correctly, and the way I think it really took off, anytime you can include social mechanisms inside the app to help people share it as often as possible and lead them back to the app, do it. As much as you can help discovery. If you've ever used, like let's say Instagram. Once I'm a part of Instagram, it starts pinging me through the social graph. Hey, your friend Zank Bennett just joined Instagram, and all these little social sharing features. So what we did correctly is every time someone shared a collage in the app, which is the whole point, you create a collage and share it. We integrated where people could share it through Facebook. So little things that we did there is when someone shared it to Facebook, it would now go into a folder labeled Collage Frame Shuffle. So now all of the things that they made with that app had my name on it. When someone would share a collage via Twitter, we pre-populated that message with made with at Collage Frame app. So people could follow that back through us and find us that way. Anytime someone shared it on Instagram or Tumblr, with Flickr, we automatically integrated so that people had the option of including the photo with one tap into our Flickr group, which helped discovery and helped everybody see it through their Flickr streams. So I included all these communities where I knew photographers were spending time and tried to do as much of the heavy lifting as I could when someone would see that, hey, this was made with this app. Oh, sweet, I want to go check that out. And there's a link they can click right in there to feed it back to me. Yeah. So I also did outsourced spamming, let's call it. So I hired a couple people on Elance, I think for around $3 an hour for two pro accounts on Flickr. And I went and got into every single collage group that I could and created a templated message just saying, hey, I saw you do a lot of collages. You know, I have a free app in the store. I thought you might check it out. You know, let me know what you think. In the meanwhile, feel free to check out my stream, you know, and add me here, and made it very personal. But again, it was templated. And I found out very quickly that, Yahoo, the owner of Flickr, limits you to sending out 250 outbound messages per day before they cap it. Yeah. So I would have them send out 249 and then stop for the next 24 hours and resend it. And I did that through two accounts. So I was able to message several thousand people that way for really inexpensively.
Cool. Do you have any idea what the conversion rates are for those?
I was able to track. I used a Bitly link so I could track exactly how many people clicked it. And I'll have to get that as a follow-up for the call. I think it probably ended up paying for itself, but it did create some more downloads, which you know, then upgraded. So I think it was profitable, but not a ton. But you know, paid for itself, which was just great marketing. Cool. Anytime it pays for the action, that's great.
And can you talk about the negative stuff?
So the negative stuff, it's the iTunes Store is an interesting place. So many development communities, if a user's unhappy, if they're unhappy with a function or whatever, they can usually get in touch with a developer. They can give you feedback. This doesn't work because of this. Here's what I'm using, here's my computer, you know, whatever. With Apple, all they can do is just leave a statement that you can't reach them. So maybe Johnny123 says, this app blows, and that doesn't really help me. I can't really do a lot with that. But sometimes people would say, you know, this was good, but it needed improvement here. And I'd say the thing that I learned from the negative feedback, it's not just the people who blast you for no reason because they're just, you know, not gonna help. But the people who said, you know, 3 stars, I like this app because of this, but here's where I would really see where it could really shine. You know, people giving you very good advice from that. In fact, Tim Ferriss actually, in one of his most recent blog posts on how to, I think it was Make $1 million with eBooks, he talks about going and finding your audience and going and reviewing competitors' books on Amazon, skipping all the 1 star, skipping all the 5 stars, but going right for those 3 star reviews. Those are the ones with the honest critical feedback that you can use as a product set. This was good, but it was lacking this. Yeah. Just correct what was lacking. So I went to some pretty interesting extents. So a lot of these people, Apple actually gives you the ability to retract your feedback and instead of 1 star, if they fix your problem, you can go back and change it. So some of these people, I actually went and I just Google searched their username, which sometimes they use the same username for Flickr, or they use it for Facebook or whatever. So I was actually able to locate a fair amount of these people just by Google searching and doing a little bit of digging. And I was able to find them on Facebook, find them on LinkedIn, and send them a personal message. Hey, I'm the developer of this app. I saw that you had a problem with this. I wanted to see if I can help. Can you tell me what version of iOS you're having? You know, I want to help you here. And the ones that I got through were just, they were blown away. There's like, I have never, ever received a message from the developer of an app. I thought no one ever read these things. I was just pissed off at the time. You know, and you pinged me and got a hold of me in less than 24 hours. That's unreal. And every single one of them, without a single exception, went back and gave it a 5-star from 1-star. Awesome. So I told them how I was fixing it, told them what was going on, and told them, you know, here's my email address, keep in touch with me. So that goes a really, really long way.
This is that personal thing you keep doing so well. You make it, I think this is like the Mike.
You're a real message. Person. You know, it's you got to separate yourself from a company because people care about the real person. You know, I just tell people, I'm one guy. I'm a photographer. Like, I'm not an app developer. So yeah, if this is screwed up, it's probably because I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So, you know, I'm fixing this, but right now I'm in a coffee shop in Florence. Let me hook it up, you know? And they love that. It was real. It was a real person, you know, behind the product. And that was half my messaging in Flickr. Hey, I'm a photographer first. And I decided this was cool and I wanted to make it. Check it out.
Very cool.
Went a long way. So that was the first experience with the first app. The second app, unfortunately, I ran into some of the same problems with development. I think when you're on a very tight budget, you can't afford to hire companies that, you know, can really execute super quickly at a really high level. So we've run into some problems with the current app, which is Tintype. So it's tintypeapp.com. Anyway, I'm excited to be done with it. We're excited to push it out. It's a really slick app that lets you do some cool old school style photography. But again, I go back to the same lessons that I learned, which I made the mistake again of when we found challenges, I didn't fire them right away because I got into the same fear set. I got into the, well, we're so far along, what if somebody else can't execute here? It's going to take more time to find someone new instead of just them having it. So anyway, I'm excited for this next app to come out. I think it's going to do really well, but I've definitely learned my lesson. And this kind of segues into what I've learned overall in the app space and the new direction that I'm taking. I've learned that I'm no longer going to develop my own code for apps. What I mean by that is I'm not going to play the ego card and try to create something that's new or never been done before. If you're interested in getting into apps, there's one guy who's incredibly, incredibly intelligent here, and I've been following every word he says. And if you go to his blog, it's called BlueCloudSolutions.com. BlueCloudSolutions.com. I wish I would have seen this a long, long time ago when I first started building apps. This guy's name is Carter Thomas. He's a genius. He was the first guy to do what I'm doing now, which is called basically reskinning apps. He's flipping apps. You buy a home, you fix it up, you flip it. What he does is he buys app code bases, existing mostly games, since games are the biggest money makers in the store. So he'll essentially go out and buy a pre-existing game that's done. The product is done. The gameplay is done. The in-app upgrades, ton of them are done. The APIs are done. The software developer kits for all these slick extra features are done. And all he does is he just reskins it. He takes all the graphic design out and replaces it with something that's his own. So imagine being, you buy the code base for the original Mario Brothers and you replace it with different characters in a different environment. That's what he does. So his development time went from, like my case, months. In my case, 9 months for both apps. And really all he has to do is the graphic design time to hire a team to redesign all the individual assets, the images, change the names, and then relaunch it. So his development time now goes to a week or two.
Mike, you know, you showed me one of these apps, and for someone listening, it's not, I mean, you picture Super Mario and I picture like the logs and he's jumping with the sky. And really, you're talking about reskinning it so that it's not Super Mario. Maybe now it's Snake instead of a little man. And it's all snow in the background. And those are really the only changes that you need to make, right? I mean, you showed me
that's it.
And the guy was on a bike and then he was riding over these hills.
So if you have an iPhone, one example of this, it's a runner game. So yeah. You can go and look up Disco Runner, as in, who were we talking about earlier? John Travolta. Disco Runner. So this is one of those code bases that you can buy and skin. There's another one called Space Race and another one called Avalanche Mountain. So all these use a pre-existing code base, and that's essentially it. So what was interesting is this guy, Carter Thomas with Blue Cloud Solutions, he was able to be topical. One of the reasons I love South Park is that something happens and in a week or two they can have a new episode up because, you know, it's cheap to make. Well, it's the same thing here. When Psy and Gangnam Style went nutso, he took that Disco Runner and he just replaced it with Psy from Gangnam Style and he made Gangnam Style Runner. And the thing freaking took off. It's unreal. On his site, he gives you the actual metrics behind how that app went. So he did Gangnam Style Runner. He did Rihanna Runner, Justin Bieber Runner. He literally reskinned this code base about 10 times. And the short story here is in a year, he put out about 100 different apps in 1 year, which were cranking out a lot of passive money for him. And at the end of the year, he decided he was going to sell it. So he was able to sell his app portfolio for $200,000 in cash. So now that he's done with that, he's just doing the same thing again. Now he just has more money to play with. So he's literally just doing the same thing and reskinning all the apps again, which is exciting. So I'll be buying my first code base this week from the Pat Flynn local network meetup last week, which was fantastic. I actually met a graphic designer. We had a first call last night. I think he'll probably start designing our first app as a partner there. So that was fantastic as well.
Cool. So what's your developer base now for this new approach? You bought a code base, so how much developer input do you need?
Right. So the developer input is quite minimal, and I guess I'm still figuring that out. I'll probably try to find someone local who can come in and it's honestly take these images and put it into the new code. That's it. Everything else is complete. So it's very, very minimal. I don't even know that I would, be uncomfortable having someone overseas do that because it's so little effort.
So what's the time you think from some pop culture event occurs? Mm-hmm. I know that there's so many big things, like big events that occur throughout the year. And if you find a pop culture event, you want to build an app sort of based on that or mm-hmm. surrounded by something like this. What's the time from inception of that thought to it's all finished, taking into consideration the 2 weeks or three that it takes?
So it really is just going to, and that has yet to be seen because I haven't gone through this process yet, but really the variable here is in each of the game codes, how many assets need to be redesigned. So is it 100 images? Is it 1,000 images? That's going to be something where I'll have to look at, do I need to hire an entire team to knock this out in a week or two? But the code bases themselves are anywhere from 100 to 300 bucks that I'm looking at. So it's unbelievably, it's a tenth of what I had spent, and it's done day one.
So do you see yourself building up a portfolio of these code bases so you have a few different styles of apps?
Or, I do. Okay. So I see, and the beautiful thing about this Blue Cloud Solutions blog is he's kind of showing the secrets, so to speak, and now he's going through and actually recommending individual code bases if you want to go buy them that he personally has launched, and he'll give you all of his metrics behind it. So that's kind of the next step. So my entire purpose, by the way, with all of this, comes down to a lifestyle. And this is kind of what we all think about, and this is what 4-hour work week completely ruined me for the rest of my life, and ever being satisfied with a typical workplace job is, like many of us, I want freedom. And so right now I'm in the process of making every mistake I possibly can to try to buy my freedom. That's the way I like to look at it. Anytime that I'm working, I'm an indentured servant. I am tied to something else, even if I enjoy the job and I enjoy the company, which I do. But I think I'd rather be shooting photos and making cocktails all day, which is the end game. So 2012, the goal was to make more mistakes than I ever had. I accomplished that by a long shot. And then 2013, I realized that my new goal is to be really, it's two words, it's to fail faster. So that's my entire goal this year, is to make mistakes like I did last year, but just do way more, way faster. So everyone, if you want to, there's a really important number that I've found personally. And I have this number everywhere I look, everywhere I think about. And that number, if you write it down, is 223. And the number 223, what that represents is the dollar amount in passive income that I need to generate from these pursuits every day to be done working. For both my wife and me to replace our incomes. And so what that comes out to is really interesting, because you look at something and you look at what does it take at this point, let's say it's 80 grand per year. That's a scary number to think, how can I generate this passively? Because it's a big, scary number. But when you really look at it daily, 223 bucks is not a lot of money to make online from how many billions of people are now on the internet? It gets really conceivable to do this. So the apps are one component. I think that reasonably we could get to 100 or 200 bucks a day in just app income. I've yet to see how that'll flesh out with these new angles. But what I've been working on since then is to really follow what I'm passionate about, which is photography. And I found that I wanted to write a book on photography, but all the ones I found look like freaking science textbooks. They're 300 pages long. They're very, very scientific. There's way too much jargon there. So I wanted to create something that was more streamline and simple, and just use plain English, just like I do in my emails and my correspondence and business. And So that's the whole idea behind Hacking Photography. It's basically the 4-hour work week of photography. How do you cut through, you know, the 10,000 hours to become an expert? And how do you do it in a fraction of that time? It's basically the 80-20 rule applied to photography in plain English. So I'm just about done with the content of the book. And the whole goal here, and Zenk really helped me dial this in as to, do I want to go after, you know, charge $60 and make this an affiliate product and have affiliates pick it up? Because I think I could quite easily make it more of a downloadable course. Or do I want to put this up on Amazon for $3 and use this as a tool to capture an audience, because I don't have one currently? Utilize the 300 million people that have credit cards on file with Amazon and just send a shit ton of traffic from the book back to my website to opt into an email list, and now I have an audience that I can start working with. And that's really the goal, is to use this ebook, which is what I'm going to do, ebook and then print book through Amazon, and include plenty of link backs to hackingphotography.com with freebies and extras and interviews and kind of extra content that I can use to make people opt into the list and then provide extra long-term value around that.
You know, Mike, that's something I personally think is you know, one of the more important parts of this whole puzzle. And have you fleshed that out? Do you have a plan for exactly the type of content you want to offer people and how you're going to motivate them to get back to your site so you can, say, converge on an email so that when your second book comes out, you've got 10,000 people there already signed up to buy their, you know, qualified leads?
So I'm actually still going through all of the content. I think it's going to be quite a few different things. So I think that I'm going to pull back maybe even a chapter or two from the book, because the book's already pretty extensive and it covers a lot of ground. So I want it to be a knockout. I want it to be, you know, really good content. I think it was Corbett Barr from Think Traffic. His whole motto is just write epic shit. And that's really the whole way he looks at how to do well online, is just make awesome content. So I think I'm probably going to pull back maybe one or two of the best chapters and give little hints. For instance, I have an entire method of buying photography gear in which I can either get every cent that I've paid back out of it after I've used it, or in a lot of the times I've actually profited from using gear over a couple years. So the title of that chapter is Flipping Bikes for Beer, How to Get any Gear for Free. And it's good enough and it's different enough that I think I'll probably save that as a downloadable extra
incentive to get people.
So then there's other worksheets and there's other little kind of assignments that I have in the book that I'm going to send people back to the site for. And, you know, the 4-hour body, 4-hour chef, 4-hour, you know, work week, he does that quite well. Mm-hmm. So in order to get this extra resource, go back to the site, go back to the site, go back to the site. So I'm really trying to lean heavily on that. And then the goal after this initial ebook as an introduction to this audience is to start creating additional content that's more downloadable on my site. So one of the scares of Amazon is I'm not in control of it. Just like the scare behind the App Store is if they decide to suddenly only give you 30% instead of 70%, there's nothing I can do about that. Yep. So I'm trying to diversify outside of other people's platforms, which, thank you for scaring the shit out of me 3 weeks ago when you brought that up. On my entire plan, you said, man, I like everything you're doing, but it's all based around someone else's product and someone else's, you know, traffic and audience. So
We've heard too many stories. You know, there have been people who base, you know, all their income on one particular affiliate, something like this. The affiliate goes away, and then, you know, there you have it. And I think, you know, Pat Flynn's a great example of someone who's incredibly diverse. I mean, all his, whatever you want to call them, properties he's got in his monthly, have you guys all seen those when he puts those out? I mean, his revenue from the month, his monthly revenue statements, it's incredible. He's got so many different properties. He's making 1,000 from here, 1,000 from there. But Bluehost makes him about 30,000 a month.
Right.
And if they change their affiliate program, boy, that would really that'd definitely be a change for him.
So. Yeah. So the next step for me, kind of wrapping all this up, is once the apps are out, once the ebooks is out, starting to help capture an audience, is I want to really, I see a lot of value in affiliate marketing. So affiliate marketing is essentially giving an audience owner a piece of the pie for sharing your book and creating a sale. At the most fundamental level, I've been reading up on a lot of these guys. There's a lot of sleazy ways to do it, but there's also a lot of really, really ethical kind of white hat ways to do this as well. So I think the next step for me is I'm going to be creating a lot more shorter form content. There's a really good site in my particular photography space called Photographing Food that I found. Again, I found this guy because he did a guest post on one of my favorite sites, which was fstoppers.com. And it was essentially like how to photograph really simple meal dishes, how to light them, how to do this with just window light. It was really simple. It was very targeted. And I was looking how to do that. So I followed it back to a site, and his site is literally just, at this point, it's 5 ebooks that are $5 a piece. And they're all maybe 20 pages, and it's just a simple, here's how to go through and photograph this individual item. And he gives you different lighting setups and exactly how he did it and how to this, that, and the other.
You buy off his site?
I did. In fact, I bought off his site because it was just, it was so cheap. I mean,
What was the price point?
$5.
$5.
PDF? You get it.
Just a PDF, downloadable PDF through eJunkie, who manages the whole facilitation of collecting the money, delivering the product, reporting, everything.
Mike, very quickly, talk about, I know in this group, especially you know Steve being an author, he's talked about you put a PDF file out there, anyone can share it and just give it away. You can find it somewhere else online, but you still paid $5 for that PDF. What do you have to say to people who are worried that if you give something out like a PDF for a fee, that you know it could just be shared and then you know incredibly devalued very quickly? What do you think about that?
Well, the interesting side, I didn't even notice this morning, and it was super sneaky and super slick because I pulled up that photographing food ebook. And I didn't realize that when I bought it through eJunkie, in the very top left corner in super small writing, it shows transaction ID, this number, Mike Newton bought it on this date. And I love that.
Oh,
I absolutely love that. They're starting to hard print that on there.
So in real time, they print
when I purchased
the
it printed the transaction information. So if I go and upload that to Pirate Bay,
on every page?
On every single page of the entire PDF,
cool.
It was awesome. I love that. But suffice it to say, that doesn't matter.
Very cool.
It's a cool feature, but it doesn't matter. So the potential reach, and there's a guy in the photography space called Trey Ratcliffe, who's a real, real forward thinker. I think he has like 1 million people on Google Plus or something like that. One of those real prolific guys. He makes the case for Creative Commons. Creative Commons in photography just says, here, feel free to use my image. I'm not going to watermark it. Here's the entire giant source file that you can steal all you want. Just give me a link back. That's all I ask. And his content spreads so quickly and widely, and people tend to play by the rules. And his thought is, look, he charges for a print because he's an established guy and his stuff is very unique. For a print, it could be several thousand dollars because he has a market for it. And his thought is, you know, maybe there's a 20-year-old college kid out there that... sure, he can download the high-res image from my site. He can go out to Costco and print a really big canvas frame, you know, for $30-$50, and I won't see a dime of that. And I don't care. He wasn't my customer in the first place. He was never going to be able to afford me. But guess what? Now he's endeared to me. Now my product is sitting in his home. That has value. Yeah. You know, later on his life circumstances are probably going to change. He might have money later on down the line, and he'll buy it when he has money. And it's all a personal preference, but that's the way I look at it. Again, Tim Ferriss, you know, he was talking to a guy, I think it was Noah Keegan, who started AppSumo.com. It's kind of a daily deal for info products and geeks and whatnot. It was genius product. But, you know, Noah Keegan in an interview just kind of embarrassedly admitted that, you know, I didn't know who you were, but I ended up, I pirated your book, which is how I got to know about you. Yeah, but since then, I've recommended at least 200 people that bought this book from you because I was so ecstatic by it. And it, you know, all these people became mavens, if you will, for his message because he wrote epic shit. So I think that as long as your content's good, you're never going to stop piracy. Just like the movie industry can't stop piracy. What they should do is embrace it and figure out a different way to spread that content.
Yeah, you know, I've got some friends in the music industry, and what they tell me is that there are people looking through the big torrent engines, the biggest torrent sites out there, and they're actually looking to see where the downloads are occurring for the most popular albums, because once they know that, they know where to go on tour.
I love it, yeah.
So, yeah. Very smart, and you're making a lot of money. You make a lot more on tour now than, say, you know, whatever the ratios are. Trying to make money from iTunes selling a single song or something like this. You go sell them a concert ticket, and so they're going where the fans are.
Right.
It's a perfect example of taking what a lot of people view as a very bad thing, turning it into a huge positive, monetizing it.
Yep, and it's all a long-term play. So if you have one single product and that's it, sure, I can see how a torrent's gonna piss you off, you know, if someone's pirating your stuff. But if someone is willing to take, and again, it's different if it's a movie, right? But if we're talking about a book here, or some kind of content like this, educational content. It's your audience. It's something that's specific enough that someone's taking the trouble to go and find this somewhere else. right? They may not pay for it, but guess what? If your content's really good and they like it after reading it, they'll consider doing it the next time. Or if they don't, there's a lot of ethical boundaries around, you know, a lot of the torrent site users, you know, there's an ethos there that if they like it, then they might buy it. Or if they don't buy it, they'll at least share it with a whole bunch of people. Mm. So think of that as your marketing spend. Think of the piracy as this is just a way that doesn't cost you anything out of pocket to get in front of a wide audience.
Well, so Amazon does this, you know, they've investigated the Kindle Select program where they'll go for two or three, or I don't know if you pick the date, number of days where it's free.
Mm-hmm.
So the book is free. And so people will, you'll get, you know, 20, 30, 50,000 people,
right,
whatever it is. And a lot of authors are finding it's valuable because it's free, but they may not have bought anyways, who knows, but at least now 50,000 people have your book.
And do you realize they pay you for that?
They do.
So
Kindle Select.
Yeah. So what's interesting is the Amazon actually has a very large pot of money monthly that if you decide to give your book up for that, whatever it's called, a loaning program, wherever where you can download it, your book free and you're not charging. At the end of the month, they total up the number of downloads and they basically divvy up that money based on who downloaded what. So let's say I have 50,000 downloads. I get a proportionate share of all the total downloads of that money.
I didn't know that.
So you do monetize that. It's just quite interesting. And I see that as a really interesting way to not only get your message out there, but to also monetize it. There's a guy, I'll have to look his name up. He was the first gentleman to ever sell 1 million books on Kindle. And he did it
in the UK.
Yeah.
$1 a piece.
Yeah, he sold them for 99 cents a piece. It's just like the iPhone app, right? You don't charge $50 for an app, $10 for an app, you charge $1. The interesting side of that is that, oddly enough, Amazon knows their sweet spot. So if you join their program and you sell a book between $2.99 and $9.99, you get 70% of it. You charge above or below that, even on the below side, you only get 35%. But what this guy found was even though he was making half as much, you know, as a percentage, selling them at $1, so only making 33 cents a copy versus selling it at $2.99 and making $2, the volume far outweighed, you know, what he would lose by selling it at the higher price.
Yeah.
So it was a pure volume play and it worked well to his advantage. Mm. So in wrapping up, I've learned a lot, you know, in the past year. I've made arguably more mistakes than I ever have before, which is a very positive thing now that I look back on it, because I won't make those mistakes again. But I've seen the light. I've seen that it's very, very real and very possible to create passive income. And kind of taking a page from Pat Flynn, I'm trying to diversify as I move forward in all these different areas that I can do that. And I have a very real number. So $223 per day in passive revenue from apps, from ebooks, from anything I could think of, that equals freedom. And that's a very achievable number at a very basic level. You know, if I put up an ebook, you know, maybe it's a downloadable course for photography, because those typically carry a very high price. I charge $60 for it. You know, I give an affiliate half that, it's $30. That doesn't take, you know, that's 8 sales. 8 sales a day. Can I find an email list owner of diehard, you know, photographers or brand new baby photographers that don't know what they're doing yet, you know, that could put in front of them? And I think just with that, 8 sales a day is very achievable, and that equals retirement, you know, at 30. So that's really the goal moving forward, and we'll see how it plays out. But I'm just going to keep hitting it until it works, whatever it takes.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Mike Newton, hackingphotography.com.
Thank you guys for having me.